Only one guy in the audience, and look at that. Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the regular meeting, Thursday, February 5th, 2015, of the City of Morro Bay's Harbor Advisory Board. And I can see here that I want to call the order, and I am acting chair right now. Unfortunately, our chair was not reappointed. We're going to miss Jeff. He ran these meetings with an iron fist and was very good at doing that, and I will miss him greatly, and I wish him well in his other endeavors. I'd like to basically have a moment of silence, and then we will say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, this is at a time here that we call public comment. I noticed that there's a couple people here in the audience. Does anyone have anything to view with us that we're not going to discuss in the meeting right now? Jeremiah?
Harbor Warden, City Staff, good evening. My name is Jeremiah O'Brien, and I didn't really have a whole lot to say tonight except that we will miss Jeff. He did a wonderful job, both as a member of the committee and as chairman, and we certainly appreciate all of the work he did for the harbor here. And welcome to Neil, who is, I'm sure, will do a wonderful job. A great guy, and I've known him myself for quite a while, and he's an excellent member of the harbor and proved himself around the waterfront as a good businessman and a hell of a good guy. So, and I think that the commercial fishermen share that. I hope I'm speaking for all of them. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Yes, I think at this point in time, I should... we had a... Jeff Eccles is not here. He was... His seat was up for re-election, and he was not reappointed. We did have two members up for re-election. Dana McClish was actually renominated for another four-year term, and then Neil Maloney here was also nominated for a four-year term. Welcome, Neil. Welcome back, Dana. And Neil, would you like to say a few things about yourself and who you are?
Hello, my name is Neil Maloney. I live in San Luis Obispo, but I own Morro Bay Oyster Company, which is my business here in Morro Bay. We have two lease sites now that we operate on. One is a state lease, which is a water bottom out in the estuary of Morro Bay. We have 134 acres of ocean bottom that we lease from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we grow Pacific oysters out there we call Pacific Golds, and we sell them pretty much everywhere in California. We're in all Whole Foods in California, Arizona, Southern Nevada, and then we deal direct with a lot of restaurants from LA to San Francisco, Vegas, Colorado, pretty much all over. And we have recently acquired 1287 Embarcadero, which was previously ran by Chuck Marciel, M&M Refrigeration, for the last 40 years, doing various things that were well needed for the waterfront. He'll be missed as he goes into retirement, if he actually retires, we'll see, but... so we are, now operating there, and we'll have a nursery there. We currently have a nursery, and we're looking to expand that building into kind of a rare production facility where we have tanks that will allow us to harvest oysters, put them in the tanks, and right now we currently get closed 12 days after 0.4 inches of rain. But with these tanks, we'll be able to harvest right before rainfall or even during a rainfall, put them in this water, and the water will be filtered, UV sterilized, and then chilled, and then we can sell those oysters within 48 hours. Right now, we go through This year so far, I've had 3 months of closure so far, and there's not too many businesses that can operate like this. So this tank system is really crucial to our business, and that's why we were interested in this property. My background, I went to University of Oregon. I studied marine biology, conservation, got a minor in business. Should have got a major in business probably, but yeah, so my interest has always been in the ocean, and right out of college in 2004, I got hired by Tomales Bay Oyster Company to manage what is now my lease. Before, it was a production farm for them. I used to ship about 1 million oysters a year just north of San Francisco. And in 2008, my previous employer retired, and I was able to purchase a farm and create Morro Bay Oyster Company and kind of form it organically, doing side-of-the-road sales, off-the-dock sales, which was the harbor had allowed at the time when Rick Alger was here. And so we were selling oysters off the dock and got our name out that way and helped build the business. So, and that's where we are today. So thank you, and I look forward to serving on the board.
Thank you, Neil. You're a welcome addition. Okay, now I noticed that we have a city councilman here. Would you like to introduce yourself? Are you going to be our liaison to the Harbor Board?
Hello, everybody. Matt Makowetsky, City Council, and I've been appointed to the kind of liaison between the council and the Harbor Advisory Board. So thank you for, I look forward to your meetings.
Thanks, Matt. Okay. Consent calendar item A1. Has everyone had a chance to look at the minutes from December 4th, 2014?
Yes.
I wasn't at that meeting, but I noticed a correction that was needed. And that was in the second paragraph, Chair Eccles said his twin boys. He has a twin boy and girl. Just so you know.
That is correct. Thanks, Dana. Any other corrections? Seeing none, do I have a motion to approve the minutes from December 4th, 2014?
So moved.
Lynn moves. Second it?
I'll second.
Okay, Gene. We have a first and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. One thing that I would like to do before we get into the public hearings, reports, and appearances, I'd like to move new business, if anyone has any objection, to have the election of the Harbor Advisory Board Chair and Vice Chair right now as opposed to at the end of the meeting. Does anyone see any problems with that? So I'd like to open the floor to nominations for the Chair for the Harbor Advisory Board. Ron?
Nominate Bill LaFay.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
Okay, I have first and second. Is there any other nominations for the chair for the Harbor Advisory Board? Gene? Alan? Lynn? Neil? Okay, seeing none. All in favor of Bill LaFay being the chair, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? So passes. I'm trying to do this diplomatically, so hopefully I'm a little rusty here on this. I'd like to hold nominations for the vice chair. Gene?
I'll nominate Dana McLeish.
Okay. We have one nomination for Dana McLeish. Do I hear a second? Okay, Alan. Any other nominations for the vice chair? Okay, hearing none here, we have a Dana McLeish for the vice chair for the Harbor Advisory Board. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Dana, you're the vice chair. Thank you very much. Okay, well, with that, thank you. I will try to do my best. I have run a board meeting before, but I'll try to get up to speed on some of the ways of doing it. So I think the next thing on the agenda right now is the public hearings, and which is the Harbor Department status report. Pardon me? Oh, yeah. Chair, and does anyone have any announcements? We can go down here. Ron, any announcements?
None other than to thank Jeff Eccles for his 4 years of service on the Harbor Advisory Board. He served the board well, he served the city well, and he served the citizens well.
Thank you. Dana?
Yes, I have a couple things. 2 weeks ago, on a Thursday, the 22nd, they had a presentation by the San Diego Maritime Museum, and they did a wonderful presentation. The history part was, I mean, everybody was listening completely to the history part. It was all about Cabrillo. They have built a replica of the San Salvador, which they believe is the vessel that he explored California with, and they want to bring that boat up the coast. And, you know, they're coming to different cities, harbors, and that would be interested in hosting, and they pretty much train a volunteer group a few days beforehand, and then we would actually, citizens of Morro Bay, would actually run the program as far as all the visitors coming and seeing it. It was a really well-done presentation, and I thought we had a pretty good crowd there representing Morro Bay. So that was one thing that happened last month. This weekend we have Cal Poly is putting on a collegiate race called the Mustang Regatta. This is something they haven't done too much. The Morro Bay Yacht Club will be hosting this event along with them because we basically facilitate their student sailing team. There'll be 16 schools represented. They're sailing FJs, a two-person, small, very tender dinghy, and this is pretty much what they race in college and in high school a lot, too. So this will be taking place in the rain, most likely, and you can come watch it. I have a feeling that the racing area, because of the swell that's going to be coming up, it'll probably be down past the launch ramp between the two mooring fields because there's a nice open area there, and that's probably where it's going to be. So if you want to watch some college kids out there racing away, that's a good opportunity. Next month I'll give an announcement about the youngest kids in our Big Rock Regatta that we have annually in March. So look forward to that also. Thank you.
Ron?
Mr. Makowski, could you tell us, San Diego Maritime Museum came up here, Dana was totally right about the presentation, they came up here to get a expression of interest from the city. Are you able to let us know what the city's current thinking is on that, please?
I think I would be jumping the gun to say that there's anything formal, because that was pretty much the introductory meeting. There's two city council and mayor there, and we have not spoken about it as a council at large. But I would think, given that presentation, that's going to be coming up on the agenda. And Eric, is anything formally put on the agenda?
No, nothing formally yet on the agenda, but I think you're correct. I mean, very well received, and, you know, I was there, City Manager Dave Buckingham. A lot of support from, you know, everybody as individuals, but whether or not city council needs to take action, we'll see. Maritime Museum spearheading it, so.
I think the play in the city council, I mean, one part I see the city council, the positive feeling is, you know, is watching people's faces. But then Eric's right. I think that the big play is going to be with the harbor, with that one T-pier. And then I'm sure, given its history and when we've had those boats come up, the city will play whatever part it needs to play.
Dana?
Yeah, it was put on by the Central Coast Maritime Museum, and they're pretty much ready to handle most of it along with the city's help. So they definitely are a big part of it.
Dana, when is this event supposed to take place? I mean, is this something that's going to happen within the next couple months, or has there been a date, or is it just this is just an idea right now?
No, they were very good at how how they go about this and how they work with the cities, and the different harbors, and they go up and down the coast. They're going to go all the way to Sacramento and come back out to San Francisco, and they're looking for schedule. So they have a fall schedule and they have a spring schedule. And so we were tentatively, sounded like they were trying to get in, seeing Larry Newland, Maritime Museum's newsletter and his feedback from it, that they were hoping to do it in October, later October, not away from the Harbor Fest a few weeks or so from there. But I'm sure it's still a little bit up in the air.
Okay, thank you. Neil, do you have anything to share with us tonight? Okay. I do have one thing. I've been kicking around the idea, and I've been doing some outreach over the last year, and Eric's going to bring up, we actually, the Friends of the Morro Bay Harbor Department is in the formative stages, but now we are an official 501(c) corporation. We were able to give our first donation to the Harbor Department, and I'll let Eric explain what we did. I actually had a chance to view the helmets and was pretty impressed with the results. So if anyone is interested in Dana, Ron, and myself, and anyone else who's interested is with Becca, who is my liaison with the Harbor Department, is going to hold some formal meetings and try to get some fundraising together and some more donations to help the Harbor Department. So I wanted to just say that we are now officially a 501(c) corporation, and if anyone would like to have any information on it, they can call me at 550-9250 or call Becca at the Harbor Department. Thank you. Lynn?
Yes, I would like to talk about sea lions, our great California sea lions. About 3 weeks ago, I was getting my boat, which is a 43-foot sailboat, ready to take to the dock. I had my skiff loaded with stuff that I put in it, oars, cushions, fenders, spare set of mooring lines, various and sundry things. And I went down below to straighten up a few things before starting the engine. And I felt my boat move and shake. I looked through one of the port lights and I see something black. And think, oh, the wind came up and it's blown one of the cushions. I'll go get that cushion. It wasn't a black cushion. It was a full-grown male California sea lion on my boat, up on the deck, which is, I haven't measured it, but probably 5 or 6 feet off the water. This guy comes up and he waddles up to the bow, and starts sunning himself very happily, and I'm, of course, very unhappy. I grab a paddle, and I say, go away, go away. And he turns around and looks at me, and he growls at me. And I'm intimidated. He's not. He had turned my skiff over, so I lost everything that was in it. He bent my bow pulpit, which I will have to remove in order to straighten. I called the Harbor Patrol for help because I didn't know what else I was going to do. But then I thought, oh, I have a propane torch. He'll probably run away with that. But Scott showed up instead, Scott Mather. And Scott came over and he got his paddle out and he started shooing this guy. And this guy turns around and looks at him and growls with a big mouth open. And so we decide that the water cannon is probably the best way to handle the situation. So we get he gets the water cannon going, and yes, luckily I had detached my lifeline, so the stanchions weren't bent any more than they already had been as he jumped off the boat and swam away. And it was a very unpleasant, interesting experience, I should say, since nothing really horrible happened, but there was some damage and there was some monetary loss in this incident. And the only reason I bring it up here is because we have this floating dock out there that has been turned over to Sea Lions so they can have a very nice place to haul out. They've come close to sinking that one. So I understand there's a second one that was tied to the first one, and so now they have two big old floats that the Sea Lions can haul out on. And I heard a rumor that you're going to put a third float out there so that more Sea Lions can come into our bay and we can make them very, very welcome. I, as a boat owner, do not like this attitude. I've seen them. We know about the amount of damage that they have done in other ports on other boats. Port San Luis has a terrible problem. There are boats that have had thousands of dollars worth of damage down there. And there's been stories up and down the coast in Santa Barbara and Santa Cruz and every place else with the Sea Lions. And I would like to encourage the City Harbor Department, instead of making these animals more welcome, I know we don't want to harm them, but making life quite that comfortable may not be necessary. And instead of giving them extra floats, perhaps part of the routine could be the water cannon scaring them off the floats when you guys do your rounds in the morning and in the afternoon. I know even when I ride my bike down the Embarcadero, in one particular place, the odor, there is a stench that comes from that when conditions are right. And I'm not quite sure why the businesses along there don't object. But I know what sea lions smell like every time I go in and out the harbor, and it's sea lions, and it's coming onto the Embarcadero. That's the end of my...
You know, if my memory serves me correct, thank you, Lynn. no, we put those floats out there because of the sea lions coming on shore and the possibility of them going on boats and stuff like that. Is that correct, Eric? I mean, wasn't that the intent?
It's a complicated issue and subject, and it may be better fodder for a future agenda item, but I'll cover a few things. First off, you're not going to stop them from coming in the harbor by not making them welcome, unless you lethally not make them welcome. They're not going to stop coming in the harbor. They started colonizing that floating dock when we had boats renting it, and then they started colonizing the boats that were on the floating dock. And we tried to get them off of there. They started colonizing over at Anchor Park down below Giovanni's Fish Market and through there and the docks down there. So basically we took a stance of, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. You're not going to keep them out of the harbor. So the best alternative, rather than have them jump on boats on shore or on docks or other usable structures, we pretty much gave up that floating dock to them. And, yeah, we threw an extra dock out there because we had it laying around. If we take that dock away, they're not going to leave because they don't have somewhere to sun. There's going to be more on your boat or more on other docks, and unfortunately that's just the reality of it. You know, as a boat owner, there's certain things you can do to protect yourself and take measures to try and keep them off your boat or off of your structures. You can't do anything lethal. You can't do anything that harms them. You've got to take non-lethal measures, and it's not a simple thing to do. Us as agency folks, we can take a little more drastic measures if they're damaging property or threatening people, but it's a balancing act, unfortunately. And, you know, like I said, we adopted the best policy or the best tactic we could, which was trying to accommodate them somewhere where they're going to cause the least amount of problems and still recognize that, you know, they're protected species and they're not going away just because you don't have a dock for them to hang out on. Maybe not the answer you want to hear, but that's the reality of it. They're not going away.
I'm just not sure I agree with it, Eric.
That's well, right. I think that, you know, this could be, and rightly so, an agenda item that we should bring up if it becomes more of a problem. If Lynn's having this problem, I'm sure there's other boat owners that have the same issues. So, and is it true, Eric, are you going to put another third floating dock?
I don't know where that rumor comes from. We've talked about it. I don't have any intention. This one was a leftover from a dock project on a lease site somewhere that we just took advantage of.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn. Anything else? Okay, Alan?
No announcements. I have my own opinions about the floating dock, but I'll save them for when we talk about it.
Gene?
Yeah, quick few things. We do have weather on the way. Looks like it not only these lows coming through, but further on down the line there. I serviced a mooring today. It only had one pennant line on it. That line was hockled. That means that the lines had turned upside down and they were unraveling. So I put on an extra safety line for there. But you guys only have one morning, tomorrow morning, to make sure your boats aren't going to float away. A couple other notes there. I saw some dolphins in the bay the other day. It's kind of nice, some little dolphins swimming around. And then on February 14th, next weekend, we have the Big Bad and Ugly Surf Contest. So, wax up.
Now, Gene, I hear that you're the one who came up with this name. At least it was in the paper that you're the one who called it this, and it's the third longest running surf contest in either, I think, in California. Longest running, 25 years now?
Yeah, it'll be 25 years. We've been doing it for a long time. Sometimes it's big, bad, and ugly. Sometimes it's just ugly.
Okay. Well, if anyone would like to see the good, bad, and ugly, come on out to the Rock, right, Gene, on the 14th and the 15th of February. Okay. Without any announcements here, I think we will go to public hearings, reports, and appearances. And if I'm not doing this right, Eric or Polly, let me know. The Harbor Department status report is on the agenda next. Eric, would you like to give us a little bit of preview on that?
Sure, and you're doing just great. Fair amount of stuff to cover here, and welcome back, Dana, and welcome, Neil. A lot of things to cover here, and I'll try and be brief, but usually I'm not. Fair amount of city council action over the last couple months. As you know, we didn't have a February meeting. We tried. Jeff and I tried to schedule something the weekend that we identified back in the December meeting as a possibility. Didn't work out because I think I was down in Long Beach at CMANC meetings, and just that's why we canceled January. It's just troublesome trying to get together January. So there's been a fair amount of time passed. The December 9th meeting, the council adopted Ordinance 588, which changed our fishing vessel slip qualifications. As you recall, we had the input from the Commercial Fishermen's Organization and others to try and simplify the commercial slip qualifications from that net tonnage for thousands of dollars, and did a simple 26 feet and under, $5,000, over 26 feet, $10,000. We've pretty much got everybody that's out there in our slips right now, submitted everything they need to submit. For the most part, everybody, I think we had one or two boats that kind of got caught behind the curve because they were used to producing $5,000, but so far it hasn't been a problem, and a needed welcome change there. At the January 13th meeting, council authorized additional funding to complete our lease site gross revenue audits that we started probably 2 years ago now. And we're supposed to be auditing our lease sites at least every 5 years for percent gross payment requirements, and making sure that what's been reported to us and paid to us is actually what the lease site made. We're trying to capture three fiscal years, 9, 10, 10, 11, 11, 12, and our auditor's been working on that for a couple of years now. It's got pretty complicated and convoluted, way more involved than we had originally anticipated, either from the staff standpoint, our auditor standpoint, and even our leaseholders. So we've had to pump in a little bit of extra funding, $20,000, to complete those lease site audits. So hopefully we'll be wrapping those up this summer. As Neil stated earlier, we had a lease site assigned to Morbay Oyster Company from Chuck Marcial, M&M Refrigeration, back on the 13th. Also on the 13th, the city accepted the quit claim deeds from Dynegy, the power plant owners, for the Triangle Lot property. That's one of the very last steps for us finally owning that Triangle Lot, so that will play into the city's future, and we'll see what comes to be of that in the future. And also on the 13th, we brought lease site 6262W, which is Kayak Horizons, one of the smallest, if not the smallest, lease site on our waterfront, to City Council for possible action. It's within about 3 years now of expiration. The previous leaseholder had earlier expressed interest in continuing on with the lease and doing some redevelopment, but he's since changed his mind. And the owners of the lease site next door, Gray's Inn, the Bastons, who recently bought that lease site from Josephine Gray, are working with Mr. Kruger at possible buying out that lease site and redeveloping it on their own. So City Council okayed going on and continuing on and following that path, so we'll see if that comes to fruition here in the near future. At the January 27th meeting, Council approved a new license agreement with Cal Poly for their, if you've ever been at the North T Pier, they've got a little work barge down there. They've done some bottom paint anti-fouling work and some fishery larval stuff down there, and they do various Cal Poly research and education activities down there. And so their agreement that was that they had, it expired, so we went to City Council for a new agreement, new two-year agreement. So they'll be keeping that for another couple of years. And they also approved an extension of the Lisa Wise Consulting Agreement for the Boatyard Haulout market analysis. As you know, our original timeline, I think, had that analysis completing sometime in November or December due to a number of circumstances. Not unsurprisingly, it's just taken longer than anticipated. And the original contract, I think, only went to mid-January, so we had to extend that up into the end of March. As you'll hear from the committee a little bit later, we've got some activity there. Recent events, Cayucas Polar Bear Dip went off on January 1st with nary an incident. Great attendance as usual. We were there as water safety backup, and we used that as a training exercise working with other agencies. Winter Bird Festival occurred January 16th through the 19th. Good attendance there. I know when I was out and about during that week, personally over the weekend, I saw bird festival activity all over the place from Estero Bluffs and down into Montana Arrow, so they were pretty spread out all over, so it was good to see all that event going on. On January 27th, we held a ribbon-cutting ceremony for our new oil recycling center in the Front Street parking lot, back where the Harbor Festival stores their stuff. As you know, we've been taking used oil and coolant and batteries and whatnot for quite a number of years now, probably a good decade or so. We used to be housed in a pretty unsubstantial pair of what was used to be some sort of outhouses, metal outhouses. Don't know where they came from or how they ended up there, but that's what our facility was housed in. When the new lift station came in a couple of years ago and got rebuilt, we lost those that facility. We ended up moving into the old containment, concrete containment berm that was built for the ferrous chloride tank for the lift station that moved. So now we've got really tertiary containment. If anything spills within our building, it's contained within concrete foundation. So we got a grant from IWMA, the Integrated Waste Management Authority, County, San Luis County, IWMA, which is a Cal Recycle grant. Got some NEP funding for that. Our own Scott Mather was on the one on the ground, specking things out and buying things and getting the company to come down and build that structure. Lori Mather in our office, she handled all the grants and taking care of all the paperwork that came from Scott. Lori Mather? Well, that's Scott's wife. Lori Stilt, sorry. and the rest of the staff helped out as well, trying to make that a reality. So we had a good ribbon cutting. We had the mayor and several city council members there. We had Kachio Shajian's office represented. And a number of other folks came down to that, so it was a good ribbon cutting ceremony. So that new facility is up and running, and now we're looks real good. Hopefully it'll continue on for a long time. Harbor Patrol happenings on the 19th. It's been fairly quiet, knock on wood. I always do. On the 19th, the Harbor Patrol got a call in the evening of a family stranded over on the sand spit, which is not uncommon. For those of you out there in TV or radio land, when you go out on high tide and go kayaking on this bay and see vast acreage of open water and think you can kayak anywhere, don't be fooled. The tide goes out and leaves you high and dry in the mud. And as Neil knows, that mud can be deep and thick and smelly and hard to get through. So these folks had gone over the sand spit. Fortunately, they were over on the sand. Tide went out. They got stranded. They called us. We made our way by land to try and get to them. And then we also took an old surf rescue board that was cut in half, took Finn out, and basically we knee paddled across the mud. It worked pretty darn well. And so one of our patrol folks, Jeremiah, knee paddled over through the mud and got to them, and then we hooked them up with state park rangers on the other side and drove them out. So not uncommon, but just beware when you're out there on the bay. The tide goes out and you've got no water left, and if you're out in the middle of the mud, it gets even harder to get to. So that was a good result out of that one. As Bill said earlier, the Friends of the Harbor Department, through the funding that they've received, the generous donations they received, we purchased a new PWC, which is our jet ski, our rescue jet ski helmet and radio microphone system. As in my staff report, we struggled with communications over the years. Think of yourself riding a motorcycle and trying to stop a dirt bike, off-roading on a dirt bike, trying to, you know, jump and get crazy on a dirt bike and listen to a cell phone at the same time. It just doesn't work, and we've struggled with various different pieces of equipment over the years to try and get communications, because communications and any rescue are really key for talking either to the victim or to other rescue folks, you know, trying to coordinate. And these new pieces of equipment came out of Australia, relatively inexpensive. We've been looking at these systems for years, but they were all kind of mil-spec, $5,000 to $7,000 pieces of equipment, and just kind of out of our reach from a price standpoint. So these new pieces of equipment came up, and we're able to purchase one from Friends of the Harbor Department funding, and it works great. As Bill said, it's basically a bone mic. The microphone, you know, kind of talks through the bones in your ears. You can talk, and you can be riding it and hear conversations going on. You don't have to shut down the engine, and you can talk. And when you're riding and talking to somebody else, they can hear you, and it's not just sounding like, you know, the muffler of a motorcycle. So it's a vast improvement. So we want to thank Bill and the Friends, and encourage folks to come out and participate in that. So it's been a great addition to our pieces of equipment there. And we're looking for buying a second unit here pretty shortly. Did some derelict vessel demos in early January. The boat Kingfisher, wooden powerboat Kingfisher, 40-footer, that came out of a lien sale that we did. Basically, you know, traded owners over the years, and the last owner really couldn't handle it and pretty much gave up on it, so we ended up with that. That was all with grant funding for $4,500 from Department of Boating Waterways. The good news, the bad news is, you know, another derelict boat that we get left with and have to deal with. So ongoing process that we do there, and we've got some more coming up probably in February or March, because recreational rockfish season starts April 1st this year along with salmon season, so we're trying to get them all the way while the ramp is pretty much closed. CMANC, the California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference, that's the trade group of pretty much every municipal port and harbor on the California coast, basically to go lobby and advocate for our needs, from dredging to infrastructure to all the things that ports and harbors need. They had their annual winter meeting down in Long Beach that I attended, kind of plotting and planning for our Washington, D.C. week, which is coming up in early March. Where this year, typically it's been myself and the mayor, harbor director and mayor, going to D.C., to make the rounds with Corps of Engineers and our legislators and Office of Management and the Budget, OMB, NOAA Fisheries, a gamut of different folks to advocate for fisheries and dredging and all those good things. This year we're going as a trio. We're bringing the city manager this year, David Buckingham. A couple of reasons. One, to get him quickly up to speed on issues, and two, you know, he had a 27-odd year career in the military, in the U.S. Army, and he's got a fair amount of contacts in Washington, D.C., so hopefully we can take advantage of some of those. And hopefully you can help show us around D.C. a little bit more. Topics of primary concern, ongoing copper bottom taint. There's a number of harbors in this state that are copper challenged with their water testing, and that they've got higher copper loading in the water column than is allowed by law, and they're under pretty strict guidelines in trying to bring that copper down. Boat bottom paint's been identified as one of the potential sources of that copper, so copper bottom paint's a big issue right now, and how you get it out of the bottom paint and put something that still works, that doesn't reduce the level of, you know, bottom fouling and invasive species. You know, bottom fouling brings, you know, less economy to the boat in terms of using more fuel to get from A to B, potential bringing invasive species. So it's a pretty big issue that the state's trying to wrestle with and how to resolve. So that's one of the big issues that's going on right now with CMANC. As far as our budget goes with the Corps of Engineers and our dredging, this current budget year, FY15, we are fully funded for the dredge ship Yaquina coming in May for about 20 days as usual. The Corps of Engineers did get about $48 million increase to their operation and maintenance budget for the country. Unfortunately, LA Division wasn't able to secure any of that for Morro Bay, but we've got what we need for this year. We're advocating for $7 million for FY16. That's primarily going to be one of our messages when we go in March, because we're due for another whole channel dredging. We last did it in 2009, 2010. Got a few high spots starting to show up, so we're starting to lobby the Corps of Engineers and Congress and the President's office to try and get us funded to about $7 million to get that done in FY16. So that's about it for Washington Week. D.C., There's a Harbor Department update. We are now doing a monthly update. Each department head is doing a one-pager. I believe is eventually going to get posted to the city's Facebook page, if you're paying attention to that, and to the city's website. This will go out to the community. So there's a few things there. Back in December, we did some more derelict vessel demolitions. This was after the Harbor Advisory Board meeting. One was a glowing star, which was a pretty classic old Chris Craft back in the State Park Marina that kind of lost its glow after sinking for, I think, the third time. Owner gave up on it, and we demolished that boat. And also an old derelict commercial fishing boat, the Viejo del Mar. A couple of photos there to the tune of about $7,400 for both of those boats. We had a shark attack on December 28th, as probably everybody knows, out on the Sandspit. Pretty lucky spate of circumstances. One, the victim was an ex-medic with the military, so he had a military mind on his shoulders and thought pretty quickly on what to do and how to self-rescue himself. He had a number of friends very close by that all kept their heads and all got him to shore. There were people walking on the beach, and everybody's got a cell phone now, so emergency services were called pretty quickly. We went down initially by boat and by jet ski, and we ferried two people in by jet ski and got the first level of care to him, making sure that bleeding was under control. Fortunately, he took great action. He and his friends took great action. Didn't nail any major arteries, so his bleeding was under control, and they ended up helicoptering him out, and he's doing just fine. Light boat parade went off just fine December 6th. I think that was right after our last meeting. About the usual 22 participants, great weather. In fact, I think it was not very Christmassy. It was probably in the mid-60s. It felt pretty warm and balmy. It's kind of an odd night. Had one boat run aground on a high spot. I think that was down off the old fuel dock, you know, down around the corner there, between maybe channel marker 16 or so. But we got them pulled off. Tide was coming in, which was good, so it was more a matter of just wait a little bit, and so we floated that boat off. And otherwise, the parade went just fine. Had a pretty good storm event, second week of December, 3 inches of rainfall. I think that's probably the last significant rainfall we had. Had a good amount of wind, had gusts of 75 knots, but I think everybody got the word for the most part, and not a lot of stuff breaking loose. It was pretty short-lived, too, so everything went fairly well there. A couple other things I want to bring up. Remind Harbor Advisory Board members and anybody in the public to sign up on Notify Me on the city's website if you want to receive advisory board agendas by email. You can be notified of a ton of different things on the Notify Me, from city council agendas, all the different advisory board agendas. So go ahead and get on the city's website. It's pretty easy to find. Notify Me's got its own little box you click, and it gives you a drop down of all the different things you should subscribe to. So make sure you get subscribed to the advisory board agenda, and save us some paper and save Polly from having to figure out who she needs to send to and who not. You'll get it automatically. And the last but not least, at a recent meeting, I can't remember if it was November and December, we had public comment about a couple of vessel accidents from one of our boaters in Morro Bay, stating that the dredge back in 2009-2010, remember the excavator dredge, hitting and damaging his boat, and that alleging basically we didn't follow through on the claim or report on that. The reporting party of that, the owner of that boat, claiming that that accident occurred at night, so we weren't around, so we never took a report because we weren't involved. And we contacted the dredge company, AIS, about that, and they never received any claim or any kind of information from those boat owners either, so not much we can do with that one. The second one was this boat owner's boat was anchored in the anchorage area. He was hit by a transient sailboat trying to leave the anchorage. We contacted that boat owner. I looked at our logs. We did log it. That boat owner did try to contact the owner of the sailboat in question. Didn't like the disposition of the person in question, and so he motored off. We did get his information. We also contacted the boat owner that reported being hit, and they, through the log evidence that I have, he stated that he thought the damage was minor and didn't need to do any report. So other than logging it, we made no report. We put both owners in contact with each other, and since the damage was under $500, as was claimed by the boat owner who was hit at the time, the fellow alleging that we didn't do anything, under $500, there's no report required through Department of Boating Waterways, so we just logged it in our daily log. So I just wanted to bring that back up in case anybody's wondering, and sort of clear our names for when things like that get alleged. I don't like those things going undone, so that's the story of that one.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there any questions for Eric with the staff report?
Did you rescue any kayaks in that family rescue?
Did we rescue any kayaks? Yeah, we ended up getting, Parks ended up, I think, helping them get their kayaks back. Yeah, they were there, pulled ashore. They pulled them ashore on the sand spit and then went over and over to the beach and came back, and kayaks were still there, high and dry. Tide had gone out, and they were stranded. And they waited until just before dark, wondering if the tide would come back. It never did, so that's when we got the call.
Eric, this is a minor point, but just for my clarification and maybe for the public's clarification, on your monthly statistics, as you're listing these things, 142 calls for service, you know, 15 emergency responses. What is exactly is a call for service? I mean, I know, is it someone that calls you on the phone and you're logging that in there as a, I mean, is there any criterias just so that if anyone is interested?
Yeah, it's a good point, Bill. Thanks for bringing it up. I'll maybe go down the whole list. So calls for service is anything really that requires our officers to go out and do something. Emergencies are in the next line, and they're a separate category. Obviously, an emergency response is emergency response. Call for service is anything from a vessel tow, someone asking for a courtesy tow, somebody calling about a kayak floating down the bay, non-emergency, going out and shooting the sea lion with a water cannon, anything under the sun that we have to go out and anything we have to go out and go help somebody with is a call for service. Emergency response, fairly obvious. Assistive other agencies, that's when, let's say, State Park calls us because they've got something going on in the Back Bay or over on the sand spit. Police department needs to get a ride out to a boat to check on somebody, any other agency that calls us for help. Enforcement actions, those are anything from writing a citation to, you know, warning somebody from overstaying on a dock or any number of gamut of things there. Maintenance actions, those, we do a fair amount of maintenance, you know, routine maintenance on our boats and vehicles, so there's a lot of those, little small things that just add up over a month to a couple hundred per month. And then small craft advisories, that's pretty self-evident. We just like kind of like to log the weather and what it looks like, and 16 days of that month with small craft advisors, either for wind or hazardous seas, and then 7 days of hazardous bar warnings.
Neil?
Yeah, on the maintenance actions, are those maintenance within the harbor, or is that, you were starting to talk about the boat, your own person, the harbor department's boats, is that?
All of the above.
Okay.
We go rebolt down a cleat. We go nail on some dock fender rubber. We go change oil on the boat. All of the above.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Dana, you have a question?
I saw a Coast Guard boat that came in today. Do you know anything about that? Do they have another new boat, or is this just temporary? It kind of looks like some kind of a tender, work tender of some sort. It was on a trailer, about 24 foot.
Pretty square bow on it?
Somewhat, yeah.
It's probably the agents and navigation guys, the guys that do the buoys. They're changing batteries or changing out a sink or something.
Okay, just thought maybe they had. Is that something they keep here? Or?
No, it's down in L.A.
Okay.
They trailer up a couple, three times a year we see them.
Thanks.
Yeah, they were down at the launching ramp area this morning at about 9:30.
I saw them.
Okay, thank you, Dana. Any other questions here? The other thing that I would like to comment on here as we move on our agenda for unfinished business, you know, I do have I've never been a firm believer in reviewing a lot of these rules and regulations in open public, but I know it does have to get done, so tends to get a little tedious. What I'd like to do, if no one has an objection, is to switch C2 and C1. And so that maybe we could put a time limit on the rules and regulations as we go through this evening. So does anyone have any? So we can get to C2 right now, which is the update and the report from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee on the committee's recent activities, findings, and recommendations with regard to the draft work products received to date from Lisa Wise Consulting. Now, Ron, you are the chairman of the ad hoc committee. Would you like to comment on your update and your report, please.
Given the level of interest in this topic throughout the community, I'd like to indulge the board's and the public's patience a little bit by providing a synopsis of the report that the committee provided to the board. This has been going on for a long time. Folks have asked a lot of questions, and I don't know that they necessarily have gotten the information they might be interested in. So this is a status report. In December 2013, a consulting firm by the name of Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc. offered to the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, which I'll acronym as CFO as I go forward, a proposal to conduct a study focused on the demand for and the feasibility of a Morro Bay boatyard and haul-out facility. In early March of 2014, the Morro Bay City Council identified an opportunity to participate in a boatyard and haul-out facility study as co-clients with the CFO. But the study morphed, and we'll get to that in a minute. The council then asked the Harbor Advisory Board to review the consultant study proposal, and in March, the Harbor Advisory Board formed a Marine Facility Ad Hoc Committee, tasking it with reviewing the study proposal, as well as reviewing any subsequent study work product, reporting to the Harbor Advisory Board, and coordinating with the city's contract liaison, the Harbor Director. The Ad Hoc Committee is comprised of Adrian Harris, who's the director of the National Estuary Program here, Jeremiah O'Brien, representing the Commercial Fishermen's Organization, and three members of the Harbor Advisory Board, Alan Allward, and Dana McClish, and myself. In late March of 2014, the consultant produced a study proposal dated March 27, 2014, identifying the CFO and the City of Morro Bay as prospective co-clients. The ad hoc committee reviewed the study proposal that was as was asked and provided its review questions and its comments to the city liaison, the CFO, and to the consultant. The committee's review questions and comment topics included the study's proposed methodology, study scope, and study schedule. In May of 2014, the Morro Bay City Council approved the city's participation in a study contract, and that contract incorporated the scope of work as it was written in the consultant's March 27, 2014 proposal. In early August of 2014, the ad hoc committee was asked to review the consultant's draft document entitled, quote, Morro Bay Boatyard Haul-Out Facility Survey, end quote, which the committee did, providing its review comments and questions to the involved parties. The survey is intended by the consultants to be a primary data gathering tool relative to demand for a prospective marine facility here in Morro Bay. In mid-August, the ad hoc committee was asked to review the consultant's draft document entitled, quote, case studies, unquote, which it did, providing the review comments and questions to the involved parties. The case studies elements was a piece of the consultant's scope of work and involved them examining three boatyard facilities on the California Central Coast, existing boatyard facilities in the California Central Coast, and asking them a series of questions. In September 2014, the, quote, Morro Bay Boatyard Haul-Out Facility Survey, end quote, was administered locally in the Morro Bay area. In October 2014, the consultant published a, quote, case study memo, end quote, document dated October 14th. On November 10th, 2014, the consultant published a draft boatyard and haul-out market analysis. So in November, the consultant distributed to its co-clients and, by extension, the ad hoc committee, its draft full report. The committee performed its review, provided its comments and questions to the harbor director as the city's contract liaison. Additionally, the committee's review notes were subsequently summarized by the harbor director in a document that was distributed internally on December 5th. And thanks to the harbor director for doing that. On January 5th, 2014, the consultant published its, quote, responses to ad hoc comment on boatyard and haulout market analysis draft report. In other words, on January 5th, the consultant responded to the summary of the ad hoc committee's comments as prepared by the harbor director. And I believe the harbor director may have included some of his own comments in that document as well. I believe that's correct. On January 14th of this year, the ad hoc committee received and reviewed copies of two documents recently published by the consultant, quote, Morro Bay Boatyard Haulout Demand Revenue Figures, end quote, and an untitled document addressing boatyard haulout facility spending projections. Those two documents, I believe it's correct to say, were produced by the consultant at the request of the city liaison following internal discussions, between the harbor director and the ad hoc committee about the need for some sort of quantification of the financial demand as an element of the market demand analysis report. And in the November draft, that sort of quantification was not forthcoming. So the liaison worked with the consultant and some data was produced. And on January 23rd, the ad hoc committee met to formulate an updated report of its activities for inclusion in tonight's Harbor Advisory Board meeting agenda. So during that meeting, during the January 23rd ad hoc committee, we had at hand the study contract scope of work. We considered the scope of work, contract scope of work, as well as the committee's review notes from the past 11 months of work. So one of the points we'd like to make, it's significant to point out that during the study period, the consultant has identified on several occasions that the current market analysis study is a precursor to determining financial feasibility. So there's some confusion. I've had quite a few people ask me about the financial feasibility study for the boatyard, and that's not what's under contract. There's a precursor element, which is a market demand analysis. That's what's under contract. Concerning the draft documents received to date for the boatyard and haul-off facility market analysis study, the committee currently offers the following points. So this is a summary of our review comments. The consultant's present work is one of our committee members identified it as a, quote, litmus test, end quote, which is a great characterization, relative to moving forward with boatyard and haulout facility feasibility. Number two, in discussing whether the draft study had or had not adequately addressed potential market demand beyond the local geographic area of Morro Bay, a majority of the committee determined that the consultants referenced potential of, quote, 5% to 10%, end quote, demand beyond Morro Bay, which data was obtained anecdotally from the consultant's interviews with these case study operators outside of the area, was adequate for the study's purposes. There was not unanimity of that opinion, but a majority of the committee felt that that was the case. The committee agreed that the study needs to clearly identify various methodology and data limitations of the study. As the committee reads the draft report, we didn't see that the consultant had identified very thoroughly the limitations that go into the results and the recommendations. For instance, number one, that, quote, outside, end quote, market demand relies on anecdotal information from yard operators in the various case studies. In other words, it's not hard data. It was obtained anecdotally. Number two, for purposes of the Morro Bay market demand study, The consultant should identify, the consultant identified a potential Morro Bay Boatyard and Haulout Facility user population of 500 vessels here in Morro Bay. The 500 vessel figure was incorporated in the into the consultant's financial demand projections for a boatyard and haulout facility. So we're encouraging the consultant to make it clear that they established that figure, and how did they get that number? Where did the count of 500 come from? Number three, the fact that of the 126 Morro Bay survey respondents, remember a survey instrument was distributed locally here in Morro Bay, out of 126 respondents, a reported 61.5% were sailboat owners or operators, and a reported 26.2% were commercial fishing vessel owners or operators. The reason we think that it's important to put that in the report and make it clear as a limitation is that the survey instrument itself identified potential user groups as including sail, motor recreational, commercial fishing, research, CPFV, and other commercial. So out of the potential survey categories, the respondents populated two of those categories. Number five, the need to clearly identify how the study survey instrument was administered. Just think it's important to say this is how it got distributed, this is who it went to, this is how we did it. Number six, the need to identify survey respondent data by vessel type and size to include the state of the respondent's haul-out frequency and haul-out dollars spent as noted. We think that's important because the consultant is using that data to drive financial demand conclusions. And number seven, the limitations of revenue projections on the basis of vessel size and over required hoist slash lift capacity. And I realize this is getting a little long and a little technical, but folks are interested, so here we go. Also, the committee recommends that the Marshall and Associates August 1998 study entitled, quote, Economic and Operational Analysis of Proposed Boating Access Facility at Morro Bay Harbor be included in the reference section of the current study. There was a prior study in 1998. It may or may not be relevant today. But a lot of folks know about it, and in fact the consultant did refer to it, so, you know, put it in the reference section. The committee agreed that if the consultant was going to address vessel dry storage, as appears to be the case from the draft documents, then projected user data needs to be reported. And there was no user data mentioned. The committee expressed an interest in the consultant including in the study a more conservative approach to facility financial demand projections, particularly in the consultant's extrapolating potential user survey results to an assumed Morro Bay vessel population of 500. For instance, on a more likely than not basis, what is the actual size of the potential Morro Bay vessel haulout population, and how is that assumption derived? If it's 500, then, you know, okay, but how do you know? And if it isn't 500, then we need something more conservative because folks are going to be relying on this data. A majority of the committee encourages the consultant to point out the difficulty of predicting variable economic factors over time when considering facility feasibility. And finally, the committee reminds the Harbor Advisory Board and the city and the citizens that the current boatyard and haulout facility market analysis does not address or capture such issues as real estate acquisition, civil engineering, environmental requirements, potential environmental benefits, bureaucratic regulation and oversight, capital requirements, financial feasibility, and other factors. The study focuses, the title of the study is Market Demand Analysis. And my final comment is actually a question. Eric, do you have any current information as to when the consultant intends to publish the final report?
I do not have a date certain. Tom Hafer, Commercial Fishermen's Organization, and Jeremiah and I met on the phone with LWC this afternoon, and we kind of went over the report, waiting a little bit on what, if anything, comes out of the Harbor Advisory Board, if we've got any kind of direction or hopes, dreams, desires, and we'll get back to them. But they did commit to as fast a turnaround as they can. I'm hoping a week or two to get that back. We do need to get this potentially back here or over to the City Council to take further action if we've got a report that we're all good with and we need to keep the ball rolling.
Thank you, Ron. Is there any questions for Ron here? Dana?
No, I'm part of this meeting and the committee of all these all this information that he just got done talking about, and this is pretty much what we agreed upon.
Neil, I know that you're fairly new, so but do you have any questions?
No.
Lynn? Okay, Alan? Gene?
My comment was I would think that 500 seems like an awful high number. This practically seems like it's high to me. So okay.
I can comment on that. In the 1998 study, it was 440-something some odd. So it seemed reasonable to me that, you know, there's been some additional built mooring construction, you know, docks and things. It sort of made sense to me, roughly.
But there's only approximately 300 boats in the bay.
Well, in 1998, they drove around and counted all the boats that were in the bay, and they came up with 400 and something.
I mean, Eric's always used the figure 500 to me, too. Eric, or do you feel that 500 is a reasonable? I mean, you do the counting. You go around there. I mean, is there 500 boats in the bay?
That's the number we've generally used, that I've generally used over the years.
That's what...
I don't know when the last time I physically went and counted. I may go out tomorrow and go do that. And the number has gone up and down depending on fishing seasons as well. You know, sometimes folks are in those aren't, you know, Morro Bay based boats. But
you know, I read this summary, and maybe I am being naive, and I was a little disappointed, only in the sense is that after I read this, I said to myself, okay, so what's this going to tell me? You know, we're utilizing this study, and maybe I thought that there was going to be an economic feasibility study, but maybe this is the precursor, and I'm wrong in that assumption, but what's our next step? So we get this study. It either comes here or goes to City Council, and if we're going to do a feasibility on the dollar volume, then we're going to have to come up with more money. Now, is that going to be split between the Fishermen's Association and City? Are they willing to do that, or is that still their thought process? I mean, I just like to know what's...
That's been the plan all along, yeah.
Yeah, the financial feasibility in the market, and like Ron said, we separated those two out early on. The Fishermen's Organization got grant funding for approximately half of a market analysis and feasibility study. City of Morro Bay committed to go in halves with the CFO, and then we split out the two parts, phase one, phase two, for lack of a better term. Market analysis being, okay, if there were a boatyard in Morro Bay, undefined size, shape, color, location, would you use it and how much would you spend? And this is what this study is. So we come up with X number of boats would spend approximately Y amount of money. That's the market analysis. Financial feasibility is going to depend on a whole lot of factors. If we have some beneficiary that comes in with $20 million in their pocket and they want to build a gold-plated boatyard, you know, depending on how many numbers come out of our market, that may be supportable because we've got no capital overhead. If we've got to go buy property and build infrastructure and have a lot of capital overhead, it's going to spell a different story. So, as Ron said, the term litmus test, it's really a, you know, you dip the litmus paper in, and if it turns red, we're not going any further. If it turns blue, we keep moving forward. I call it a go, no-go decision. You know, it's we'll have, hopefully out of this report, a defined number of boats, local boats, that would patronize this facility, an estimate, high-end, low-end, of how much they would spend over the period of a year on average. And if that indicates, yeah, maybe a boatyard will make it under certain parameters, depending on how much it costs, let's move forward. It looks to me like we're pointing that direction, but we're not there yet. If we do go there, then you take that market and then start doing more robust, figuring out where the property is going to be, and the city's going to have to start working pretty hard on identifying the haul-out site and the location, and is it public, private, is it private, is it public, how it operates. All those things play into, and I would guess probably if we carry it to that next level, to that next study is going to take our market and lay it over three or four or five different scenarios on this boatyard being built from, you know, the guy with $20 million in his pocket to spend to give it to us, to the city of Morro Bay and the CFO having to go out and scrounge up every nickel and everything in between, and that will tell you whether the boatyard will make it or not.
Okay, that makes sense. I understand. Jeremiah, you had your hand up. Would you like to comment?
good evening again, Jeremiah O'Brien. I think Eric pretty much covered what I was going to say, just to clarify the financing on that bill. The NBCFO put up. So the project, I believe, and these numbers aren't exact, came to about $60,000 for the group of studies. That group of study was compartmentalized, and this particular study here, the total cost was $30,000. Again, I'm rounding out numbers, in which the city paid $15,000, and through a grant from the Joint Cable Liaison, NBCFO financed the other $15,000. We did receive total of 30, so through the joint cable we will be able to afford to finance the remaining 50%, and I believe the city had agreed to do so. If this original study that was done is satisfactory, so by compartmentalizing it, we can stop at any level and not expense any additional funds. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to go on. But again, if not, we can just stop, and those additional funds will go unspent, and the boatyard will.
I understand.
Disappear.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thanks.
Okay.
I have a comment.
Yeah, Alan.
Well, another thing that the man studied does do for us is it gives us a better idea of when they do their financial feasibility, we can give them a better idea of what we want now, because we have a better idea of how big we should build it and what type of services we would try to offer. We went into this sort of thinking about a grandiose project where we would be attracting all these boats from out of the area, and I think the idea of the ad hoc committee is that's probably going to change.
Okay, I see now. Okay. All right, any other comments here on Ron's report? Yeah, Neil.
I know I'm behind on this one, but is there a market analysis for transient boat participation?
No.
Okay.
Ron, you had a comment? Well, Lynn?
Yeah, when we have talked about having a yard before, it has not been limited to just a haul-out and repair facility, but in conjunction with dry storage being major revenue with little investment required, and that is not reflected at all in this report. Is that not being considered?
There is a reference in the draft report to dry storage, but it is simply that, a reference to dry storage. There's no applied methodology that I have seen relative to projecting potential demand or what the shape, nature, size, or whatever it would be of dry storage. And my last comment is, Bill you said what's next. That's a good question. Part of what's next is that, just to be clear, because I heard the word if a couple of times this evening, the ad hoc committee stands ready and anticipates that it will be able to do a substantive review of the final report and duly report its findings and its recommendations to the ad hoc, to the Harbor Advisory Board.
So right now we do not really have a timeline. So if we said we would like to have in our March meeting, that would probably be premature. It would have to be maybe probably April that we would have another report and you would be able to give a recommendation of the Lisa Wise consulting report. Is that correct, Ron?
I have no idea what the recommendations would be, but I think it might be worthwhile, given Eric's comment about maybe they'll produce something in the next couple of weeks. I would recommend that we put an agenda item on for the next meeting, and if we're not there, we're not there. But the committee knows that it might have to move really fast.
Okay.
We do have this ad hoc and the capital improvement ad hoc. I mean, those are standing from last year, the kind of standing orders that those go on every time, depending whether or not we've got something robust or just a couple comments to make. So we will have a committee report next week. I'm going to hope and push and try and get this on for the March agenda and hopefully get this revised final draft document back from LWC, get it back with the CFO and us and the committee, and God willing, the creek don't rise, we can get it to the advisory board in March.
Okay.
Get it back here in March. That's my hope. Whether we'll get there or not, we'll shoot for it.
Okay. Thank you. Dana?
Yeah, just to kind of answer your question more, Lynn, the committee agreed that if the consultant was going to address the dry storage, that we needed more data to be reported. So that was one of our recommendations to them. So we're looking for that to come back in the final report.
Okay, then. All right. No other comments here. Okay, you have another one, Lynn. Yes.
Yeah, on page 3 of our committee project history, it has the 8 tasks. Scoping and refinement, preliminary document, market research, etc. The report that has been submitted, Boatyard Haulout and Market Analysis, is, silly question, but which one of these? Which one of these tasks, if any, are included in this analysis which the CFO has received?
Those tasks are embedded in contract task 6. Those sub-elements. So the answer to your question is they're all there. They're all included in the contract.
Okay. Included in the contract, but in the report?
The committee, when it met recently, discussed that question, and the end result of that discussion is conveyed to you in the committee's current report.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. With no more questions here, then let's go back to, I believe, C1, which is the rules and regulations that we want to go over tonight. A review of the Harbor Department rules and regulations. And I believe we are going to go over C. Eric, if you could comment on that and get us started. and then we will go for as long as we want to tonight. Hopefully we can get through C.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully it won't be too painful. So, as you know, we've got an ongoing process.
Ron?
Is it reasonable to expedite the process? Is it reasonable without reading what we already have in front of us, unless it's necessary by virtue of public disclosure? Is it possible that the board can simply ask questions or make comments or engage in a dialogue with the harbor director on an item-by-item basis?
I would think so. I mean, this is a public document, so if anyone in the public would like to have any further data, they could go in there and get this. I think that there's, what, five elements of C, Eric, that we want to discuss?
Yeah, I don't intend to read line by line through here. I think it is worthy of a quick recap on the the five items. And give you my recommendations and why.
Are you going to take them one at a time?
Yeah, one at a time.
Okay, why don't we start?
My hope is not to, I don't desire that we try to wordsmith by a committee of 7, 8, 9 and come up with specific wording like we did with definitions. You gave me some general direction and hopes, dreams, desires, and I'm going to move on with it. I got the same idea here. So the quick background is that the November meeting, we identified a list of 16 areas that we wanted to address in the rules and regulations, one of which was definitions. That we addressed back in December. Went through those. You gave me some general direction on things, and we moved on. This is the next group. I grouped them into areas of kind of logical order, the A group being environmental, and the 9, 10, 13, 14 list underneath that are the numbers as we number them in the minutes as reported out from the November meeting. The B were more policy things, kind of overarching policy and procedure things, the B list, and we're looking at the C list tonight, which is sort of the operational things. Time limit for recreational vessel stays on the T piers, setting a definitive number on the maximum size of vessels that a mooring can accommodate, limited number of liveaboards at the T piers, commercial fishing liveaboards, the dollar day, head float berth rate, and overhead casting in certain areas. So I did line out each of those, and I'm going to keep those numbered order, so we're handling numbers 2, 4, 5, 8, and 12. I'll give a quick recap of it and my recommendation, then we can open it up for board comment. Unless we have anything from the audience, we'll see what Jeremiah has to say. Does that sound like a good way to go?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so item number 2 on the list, time limit on recreational vessels on the T-piers. As you well know, in our two T-piers, we're in the Measure D area, primarily for commercial and recreational fishing vessels. It doesn't totally exclude everybody else, but as you know, at times our piers become pretty clogged up with recreational boats. Our North T-pier especially, up until we did the major repair here last year, we were able to use that to shuffle some of those folks on, and now we're a little better status quo. Sometimes recreational boats can come pile us up too much, and we really have nothing in our rules and regulations that says no more. We need space for commercial. First come, first serve pier, and if we end up with a bunch of wreck boats, we end up with a bunch of wreck boats. So I'm looking at a potential time limit for recreational boats on the pier. Currently, we've got no coding addressing it. We would recommend that we consider some sort of reasonable time limit. It is a good option. It is a good revenue source. I don't want to completely cut off recreational boats, but do we want to put some kind of a time limit on it at our discretion to allow recreational boats a limited amount of stay? So with that, I guess I'll open it up. My recommendation is consider a limit like 6 months in any 12-month period. Kind of mirrors our floating dock, although it's our sealed dock now that Lynn so loves. Our anchorage has a 30-day limit in any 6-month period. Something slightly more generous would be more indicative to me, such as 6 months in a 12-month period, if adequate space is available. But the owner's obviously got to be currently up on their billing, and their vessel's got to be operable and seaworthy. So that's what I would recommend, and I'll open up to the board if we've got to get any input on it.
One question right now, do we have a waiting period? I was at the North T period. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like we do have a little bit of room right now. I mean, it's, especially since we moved all the boats off.
It comes and goes. Oh. It's seasonal, depending on what the commercial fishing season is, you know, and what we have biting here. But yeah, the North Deeper, like I said, we had a plethora of recreational boats. It was just way too much, and we were able to get rid of them, and now we're back to something a little more reasonable.
Okay. Why don't we start down here? Ron, do you have any questions or any comments?
No, I have two questions so that I can frame my thinking about this. Number one, in the experience of the Harbor Department, using just 2014 as a baseline, what has been the relative demand over the course of a year for A, commercial, B, pleasure? And number two, relative to consideration of a reasonable time limit, what is the experience of the Harbor Department as to what's reasonable, irrespective of what might be written someplace or might have been represented in the past?
In terms of the demand, recreational versus commercial, it depends on the pier, but I'd say without getting a whole bunch of recreational boats there, what we are now, we're probably 75-25, maybe 80-20, recreational versus commercial. Like I said, we've managed to winnow down the recreational because we had just a lot of boats that just kind of got dumped and were project boats and never got completed. You know, we've got a boat there now that's a recreational boat that's been there for a few years, and the guy's been making great progress on it. It stays out of the way. It's not a big deal. And we've got other recreational boats that are just constantly in the way that we got to move. So demand is, like I say, 75-80% commercial, 20-25% recreational. Average over both piers over the course of a year or so. Time limit wise, what's reasonable? You know, as I stated initially, we're Measure D and we're supposed to be primarily commercial and recreational fishing. But guys do come with project boats. Some people get blown in and have problems and break down. We, you know, had a number of folks that come and they decide, well, I kind of like it here. I'd like to stay a little longer. Some sort of a time limit in a 12-month period seems reasonable to me. In 6 months, you know, it's a fairly cheap alternative, but if you're, but in my mind, in our department's mind, you know, recreational boat use on those piers is temporary. It's not a permanent solution. And if you're there 6 months, you know, you're starting to get pretty permanent. If you're there for a year, yeah, now you're getting to be permanent. It becomes your permanent home, so time to move on, where it's supposed to be a permanent home for commercial boats that can't get other accommodation.
Do you mean X number of months consecutively or X number of months in a year?
Since some boats can come and go, I would, kind of like our anchorage where it's 30 days in any six-month period. It doesn't have to be consecutive. It's just a cumulative total. Because somebody could go, you know, maybe somebody goes, stays at our pier for a while, goes and hauls out of Port St. Louis for a month, comes back. Now it's not consecutive. I wouldn't see restarting that clock at zero. I think it would be a cumulative.
Do you have an opinion as to what you think the maximum consecutive period should be?
Again, in my mind, it's 6 months is a good starting point for consecutive or cumulative in a 12-month period. Some boats, it's going to catch on the wrong side because, some, like I said, we've got a boat now. It's been a couple of years, and he's not been in the way, and he's operable, and he's getting a lot of stuff done. It's just he can't find a slip anywhere else because it's a pretty big boat, and that's just where he ends up. But like I said, at some point you're getting permanent. And if we had language that left it at the discretion of the Harbor Department, whether or not we've got space for you, I think if we've got space, you know, there's times when commercial fishing use is low, and it can be for a long time. Hopefully not. Hopefully things have bounced back and we're a little more stable. But if we had some discretion with the Harbor Department, if we had space, but something to give us a hook that we can definitively call an end to it if we need to.
So my question here is that, okay, so for the in the discretion of the Harbor Department, right now, currently, if, like, for instance, this recreational boat that's been there a couple years, if we make this policy change, would that mean that that recreational boat now would have to leave the North T Pier? Is that correct? Well, I mean, it would be 6 months from the time we make the new rule.
Yeah.
And then you would kick him out and he wouldn't be able to...
Yeah, you can't go backwards. Well, if we put, like I say, if we put language in that at our discretion, if space is available, it kind of makes a gray area of sorts that someone's got to make a decision, but if a decision can't be made and it's policy or written and there's a rule and regulation, it allows us to do that.
And right now there is no rules and regulations?
Nothing at all.
I see.
Okay.
I see. So you want to put the rule in and also and or the discretion of the harbor department is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Yeah, Dina. What are the fees, just out of curiosity, for tying up there?
25 cents per foot per day currently. And a charge of a buck something for electricity? Or is it two something now? $2.35 for electricity if you're plugged into power. And there's no distinction whether that's recreational or commercial. Everybody pays the same. For every day you're plugged into shore power.
Alan, as a commercial fisherman, what's your opinion on allowing recreational boats down the North Tier Pier? Do you think it's a problem? I mean, do we have an excess, or is this something that you as a fisherman and the organization would favor?
I think that with the discretion of the Harbor Department, I think they can make good decisions, and the Measure D automatically tells them, you know, to keep things open for commercial fishing. The one thing I would like to see going along with that is if there is a sort of a fish bite here, like we used to have in the fall, albacore and a whole lot of boats show up, that you would have the power then to make room for the commercial fishing boats by displacing, you know, people that were there.
Yeah, that's where I think, you know, if adequate space is available, comes into play. Well, if we've got space, we can rent it. If not, and the commercial boats are coming in droves, recreationals are second fiddle, they got to go.
And I also wanted to know if there's a limit on how deep a stack of boats can tie up, and because I guess that's when you hit the wall, right? When you've got five boats deep or whatever it is,
we
all the way up and down.
There's never been any thing we've tried to enforce other than if people are going 2, 3, 4, 5 deep, we start requiring extra tie-up lines. I've got pictures back in the 80s of 7, 8, 9 boats deep in 6 or 7 rows. I mean, it looks like...
And that works.
It looks like up in the Bay or in Susan Bay where they got all those destroyers all tied up together. It's crazy. And it works, yeah.
Okay. All right. All right, thank you. Jean? Lynn?
I think it's a good idea to set a limit and to enforce Measure D. Keep it open as much as possible for commercial fishermen, and if there is space available, allow the recreational boater there.
Okay. Okay, Dana?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you need to have something on the books. People know that they only have 6 months, and they're going to be thinking about where they're going to go next. If you have to kick them out because fishermen are coming in, that's not going to be fair to them or, you know, anybody. It's just not going to work very well. From what I can tell, they're getting a pretty decent deal for a 40-foot boat. That's like $300 a month. So, yeah, month. Anyways, I think you have a good recommendation. I would go with it.
Okay. So that's kind of what I'm looking for, and that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Consensus for it, support for it.
Let's do it.
Move on.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Number four.
Number four. Setting a definitive number on the maximum size of a vessel that a mooring can accommodate. So the issue here is, you know, all of to accommodate a size of a boat, let's say a 40-foot boat, your mooring has to meet a certain minimum specification with block and chain and pennant line and everything else. Historically, we've never had anything in our rules and regulations or any sort of a limit on how big a mooring somebody can put down. You know, somebody might have had a 2,000-pound block, and then they upped it to a 4,000. Now they want up to a 6,000 because they want to put a 40-foot boat, a 60-foot boat, an 80-foot boat. We don't have that kind of space. You know, when I started here as chief harbor patrol officer in the early 90s, about 6 or 7 years into it, we started having boats starting to collide more because boats were getting bigger and bigger. Yacht club was an issue. Lots of issues in the mooring field, and I think we had long-standing, or at least a standing policy that no, you're not going to upgrade your mooring to a bigger mooring to accommodate a bigger boat. We'd allow people to do it if they wanted, you know, if you want to put 10,000 pounds of concrete on the bottom because it's going to make you sleep better through the winter, by all means, put 10,000 pounds of concrete on the bottom. Doesn't mean now you can put a 110-foot boat on it. And we held the line at that, but we've never had anything definitive in our rules and regulations that stated that. What I would like to do is establish a definitive size for every mooring based on its historical size and where it was and where it is now, and put everybody on notice as this is where we're going to be. Obviously, there's going to be some people that contest it, and we'll have to work through it. But we really need to put some sort of a limit, a definitive limit, on our moorings that from here on out forevermore, this is what this mooring can accommodate.
I agree. Gene?
Well, on the books right now, you have minimum requirements, 35 foot for 1,000 pound block or 2,000 pounds of concrete, 50 foot boat, 4,000 pound block. So you do have regulations already set up for those size of boats per mooring. It's not only just the weight of the block, but it's the size of the chain,
right,
and the size of the pendant line. What has happened in the past is there's just two or three, maybe a handful of boats that are at this point trying to say, well, you know, 30 years ago I had a big boat on this mooring. I think historically you can show that there was a boat bigger on this mooring and there was space, then perhaps you can negotiate with the harbor director to allow a bigger boat. But I would say I agree with Eric at this point, pretty much everything there is going to fit. And
right,
unless you can prove otherwise, that's what it is.
I agree. Alan?
Is there any way to accommodate larger boats? Is there any wiggle room? Is there any adjustment that can be made in the mooring area?
There's only so much space. There's only so much space.
Well, yeah, those mooring areas are designated by, I don't want to say Corps of Engineers, but they are a federally defined space, like a lot size, and we are constrained. I mean, hopefully someday we'll go through and GPS things and reestablish and reset, but no. I mean, as Gene can attest, you know, he's constantly, when he's doing his mooring inspections, having to, well, I've got to move this one over 10 feet, got to move that one over, because boats have historically gotten bigger. So now there's really no more room to put more moorings in or really expand them out.
How about if you eliminate some moorings?
You could, and Marina Square actually did that a few years ago. They wanted to put in big moorings because they had some customers that wanted 50, 60-foot boats in, and we told them, well, how are you going to make the space? And they came up with a compromise. They took their northernmost road where they had three moorings near Lynn's favorite seal dock and winnowed it down to two and upsized them. So they made more space and upsized the moorings.
Well, now, when you mention Lynn's favorite seal dock, something springs to my mind, a possible way to eliminate a couple of moorings and make some room for some boats to swing.
Gene?
Every mooring
okay.
Every mooring has an assessor's number, and it's 100 feet by 100 feet. And that's your block size. That's your location. That's your assessor's number right there. So, just a point of information.
I mean, these moorings cost the individuals some pretty money. I mean, I believe the last person said that bought a mooring was like $35,000. Now, I could be wrong. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a lot of money.
Well, the owner of the mooring owns the ground tackle, and he leases the area not only from the city, but he also pays the county assessors for that mooring area there. But he makes a month-to-month agreement with the city that the city at any point can remove that mooring.
No, it's an interesting arrangement.
So you can't change the boundaries?
Yeah, no.
Historically, our moorings had sold for $3,000 to $5,000, you know, for a long time, and then kind of mirroring the housing market in the early 2000s when housing prices started going crazy, the mooring prices kind of did, and yeah, some of them went up to $30,000.
Yeah.
Kind of leveled back off to the $15,000 range, but yeah, they went crazy for a while.
Well, I definitely think this is something that we do need to put on our books, and Eric, you probably have more of the information, and as Gene said, there's only a limited area, so
we should limit it to what the space is around that particular area and not have larger boats whatsoever. Dana?
Yeah, I own a mooring, and when I bought it, I was told it was a 45-foot mooring. I see advertisements, in fact, you know, giving length of what size boat you can put on your mooring. You see it at whatever price they're asking. But does the city have a list? Does the Harbor Department have a list of this is a 35-foot mooring, this is a 50-foot? I mean, because the yacht club.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so what is the largest, 50-foot?
No, there are several moorings that are rated for 55-foot. There are probably maybe a dozen moorings that are rated for over 50 feet. The rest of them are 40s, and there's a few that are rated just to 30 feet.
So 55 could be our maximum from what we're looking at right now.
Yeah, we do have, like you say, we've got a spreadsheet that shows the weights and the maximum boat sizes, and historically we've, you know, if it had the maximum boat size in 1998 of 40 feet, you know, hopefully it still says 40 feet today. But we've never had anything in writing that says thou art limited to something. So that's what I'm trying to establish is we need to limit it. And like Gene says, there's a historical what was there. You know, so we've had, and I've got a couple pending cases right now where folks are saying, hey, historically I had a 45-foot boat here. But then, you know, I got rid of the boat and I started renting it, and now the block size is this, and, you know, I want my 45-footer back. And so there are going to be some of those we're going to have to wrestle with, but I think we need to establish a definitive, you know, size of these moorings. Otherwise, you know, the potential is there for people just to upgrade, and we need to put a limit on it because it's a limited space.
Okay, Alan?
They're all allotted the same amount of territory, though?
In theory.
We pay our taxes for that same amount of space.
So what you're trying to do is establish a maximum size that'll fit within that 100-foot square.
Establish a maximum size based on the historical mooring that was there, historical size block and mooring that was there, and what we had it rated to over the years.
But it's maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it's all determined by how big a square you have, how far you can swing.
If you were to take, so the every mooring has a 3-to-1 scope of chain on it. So, I mean, I don't have my protractor and my Pythagorean theorem here and all ready to calculate this out. I think Gene does, but there's, if you put a block squarely in the middle of a 100-foot square, obviously the boat's not going to swing in a square. It's going to swing in a circle, so you're going to hit the edges of the, and not the corners of the square. And you've got your 3-to-1, you know, there's tidal variations that are going to change that. You know, I don't know if a 50, 60, 70-foot boat will fit within that, where that boat size limit stops. Gene?
In your 100-foot square, if it's in 20 feet of water, that means you have 60 feet of chain. A squared, B squared, C squared means you have about horizontally about 50 feet of chain. So your mooring ball, if it's stretched out, is already on the edge of your assessor's area. So your boat's in the other guy's square. But there are more assessor's areas per mooring zone. There may be 30 mooring assessor's mooring areas in that A1 zone, and there may be only 20 boats that are there.
Right.
The city doesn't want to have any more new boats installed in that A1 zone. So we're out in the other guy's blank space over there.
Right.
And all kind of swings goes back and forth. And it's kind of an empirical formula. It works right now. But you can't keep putting bigger and bigger boats on that area there.
Right.
If they all were, and there's a mooring system that Santa Barbara's experimented with to not great success, but there are mooring systems where it's an embedment anchor and you've basically got a giant rubber band instead of a 3-to-1 scope of chain, and you're strung pretty straight up and down with not a lot of lateral movement, but they've not had great luck with those. So you are stuck with that 3-to-1 scope to keep the bungee cord effect going.
I would like to suggest that you put the rules and regulations on the books, and I think we have agreement here, unless I hear differently. Ron?
the way Eric has written his recommendation is wise in that it actually has three separate elements. The determining what the block history is as a baseline. Number two, a definitive maximum vessel size be established based on some reasonable criteria. That's multiple factors, not one factor. LOA is not an adequate factor, in my professional opinion. Not sufficient. Necessary, but not sufficient. And number three, a definition of vessel size be established for what exactly the length or size of a vessel is determined by. Well, that one's actually fairly straightforward. But let's just take the second one for a minute, the criteria. Vessel length is one issue. Vessel weight is another issue. Windage is another issue. There are multiple criteria that have to do with the loading on a mooring block. So, Eric, what, please, would the Harbor Department, what contribution can the Harbor Advisory Board make to this needed potential policy and regulation? What could we best do for you? Would you like us to form an ad hoc committee and contribute to some of these definitions, or do you want to just handle it yourself? What would you like to do?
Thanks, Ron. You make some good points. And I'll probably defer to Gene on a part of this answer of this. Historically, with maybe a couple of exceptions on the unique situation, the mooring size, our mooring specifications, if your mooring says that you've got a 40-foot boat and your mooring spec says that your mooring block needs to be this and your chain needs to be this, I'm not aware of any major problems with those boats really dragging their moorings, whether it's a 40-foot light displacement sailboat or a 40-foot Chris Craft, wouldn't be a myth with giant amounts of windage. How they swing in the tide, yeah, those things can be major factors, but I'm not aware of any major problem of any 40-foot boat creating a problem if its mooring was rated for 40-foot, regardless of what that boat design was. Like I said, there's a couple spots where we've got that continuously scour, and the block doesn't get a chance to bed in like an anchor, and those boats have drugged their moorings. But for the most part, Gene, would you agree that, you know, if he's got a 40-foot powerboat and I've got a 40-foot light displacement sailboat, if your mooring's rated to 40-foot, you're good. The swing room is what I was kind of speaking to in vessel size. What is exactly the vessel size? And you spoke to it already on LOA. Well, if you're, you know, a traditional sailboat, Lynn, with some spars and some stuff sticking out in the front, or if you're a powerboat with things hanging in front and back, or a sailboat with stuff hanging in front and back, your effective swing room versus your, you know, the actual boat length are two very different things. Your boat may be called 40 foot, but overall it's 55 or 60 because it's got a lot of overhang. So, you know, what is the length of a boat in terms of what it can accommodate? Weight is one thing. Like I said, design so far hasn't been a major issue with whether it causes a problem with dragging the mooring. It's more fitting in the space and how it interacts with its neighbors if it's got a lot of overhang on either end. Probably didn't answer your question, did I? What can the Harbor Advisory Board do to help me on this?
Well, I think that, you know, you have the history. You know what can fit in certain spaces. Just make it work. Thank you.
Gene?
Really, two real quick points. Some of the boats will sail up into the wind, in a current, and some of them will drag butt. And so the size and the style and the underwater profile of the boat, that's just another function of this equation.
Yeah.
One of the factors that we do want to have is have the harbor director have the ability to make the decision in one way or the other. Let him have the final say.
I agree.
Lynn?
Something quite different. We're talking about the weight of the mooring primarily as determining how long a boat can be on it. But I also find it troublesome that sometimes the mooring block. I'm not saying they're dragging. They're probably not dragging for the most part. But the mooring block doesn't always get put back in the same place as it was previously. And rather than have it totally defined by block size or even history, but you have to look at the area in which the mooring is located and where that block is. There is one transient mooring in the Morro Bay Yacht Club field that is unusable. It has been moved several times. It is still unusable. You put a 20-foot boat on it, it's still unusable because it seems to connect with something else. It is... So I would like to see GPS coordinates used to place blocks and then draw the circles around them and see where you have intersection with another one.
I mean, ideally, you go through and you put like boats together. You put sailboats that are all going to ride together, and you put powerboats together. And in theory, that makes the whole mooring field live better together. But people buy these moorings, and everyone's got different boats, and you got not much control over that. Okay. Yes, Neil.
Not sure it's to the point of your regulation, but has the Harbor Department, over the years of the growth of the mooring field, started using the new technology? You mentioned GPS, but any kind of like spatial, you know, Google Earth-like mapping of where they have their moorings and to make sure that within the zone that are allotted by the boating and waterways that they're maximizing the space?
You're really limited by, you know, we've got the channel markers, which defines an edge, the eastern edge, where the designated channel is. We hope to not place any blocks right on that line because then really they swing into the channel, and that's not good. So they need to have a setback. The other limit is over on the sandspit side, and you're limited by depth over there. So that area kind of self-constrains. I think we've had historically the ones at the launch ramp going around the corner. The moorings at the southern end of that field have kind of gotten squeezed further south as things have gotten more crowded, and they're pushing further south and are probably beyond their limits, but there's nothing that they're in the way of down there, so it doesn't harm anything.
Okay. So I think that a couple points here is that you are starting the GPS. You will have the discretion to use your own judgment and to use some criterias that are on the books to make sure that some of these moorings, you know, stay the same, and we don't run into problems.
Yeah, okay. I'm good.
Thank you.
All right, Alan.
Okay, right. Number five.
Hang on one second.
Oh, Alan.
You already using depth as part of the criteria?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. When Gene or the other mooring guy inspects, he sets up on a mid-range tide, depending on whatever tide he's at. You estimate the mid-range and then do 3-to-1 scope on that. That's in the specs. That's already there.
Okay. Okay. Number five, allowing a limited number of commercial fishing vessels to have liveaboard permits at the T-piers.
Right. So currently, as written, the liveaboard ordinance in Chapter 50 of the Muni Code, 1540.020, states that the T-piers are not to be used for liveaboard purposes by anybody. Liveaboards are defined as, you know, a vessel that uses more than 60 days in a 12-month period with somebody living aboard or doing the usual and the customary things associated with one's abode, blah, 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 blah. The liveaboard ordinance was created in the early 1990s, and it prohibited liveaboard use of the city's T-piers. My understanding of why that was done was because of the T-Pier fire in 1989. That was a commercial fishing boat that was being lived aboard, and some power overloading happened, and I think it was more a function of very inadequate shore power cord, which we've enacted rules to what people can and can't use as shore power cords, and we're pretty strict on that.
and we're much better on keeping up on that regulation and on making sure that our plugs are all in good shape, because as you know, corrosion builds up and electrical problems happen. There's been a number of incidents we've had on the piers. We do have what I'll call, for lack of a better term, sneaker boards on the piers, people that don't have liveaboard permits that are on the piers, primarily commercial fishing boats. And they have, under multiple occasions, at least three that I know of, stopped or prevented fires from happening on the piers. I know we had one boat fire and at least two on the pier where the piers were starting to catch fire, and a guy that happened to be living aboard a commercial fishing boat caught it and put it out. We've had a number of medical issues on boats that liveaboards on the piers have been instrumental, just like the liveaboards all over the bay. They're almost, not always, but very often the first line of defense and the first ones that notice something wrong. So, you know, in our opinion, you've got commercial fishing boats that have permanent crew members on them. They're a good preventative force. They're a good watchdog force. Our rules and regulations on cords have gotten much better, so that electrical issue is gone. We believe that, getting past not allowing liveaboards on the piers should be done here. We believe that it ought to be for commercial fishing boats only. Again, get away from the recreational. We're Measure D. We want to be commercial fishing. Because there's guys that crewmen and owners that pretty much live on their boats, and they need to do it. And we're in this catch-22 that we try not to allow liveaboards at the piers, but when we've got these commercial fishermen that are legitimate operating boats, and and they've got nowhere to go. They're big boats, some of them. So we feel staff, we've worked internally and feel that there should be a limited number of liveaboards at the piers allowed. The number we came up with is three per pier on basically a first-come, first-served basis. And only if you're a fishing boat that can qualify, just like we do for our slips, that you show that you're an active working boat and that you're operable and seaworthy.
So basically what you're saying is you'd like to allow up to six commercial fishing boats to be liveaboards. Is there a time period or just at any given time?
Yeah, at any given time. If there's three, number four comes in, you're going to have to wait until somebody leaves.
Okay. Alan?
So I'm thinking of one guy in particular who goes fishing in albacore all summer, and then he comes back and his deckhand lives on the boat. So when he goes fishing, will he lose his spot as, or is he going to have a year-round liveaboard permit, or how does that work?
Yeah, the permits are now good for 2 years. And there is an actual provision. I can go dig it up, but it'll just take time. If you're gone for a season like that, a couple, 3 months, a lot of our sailing boats and other liveaboard boats do that. So, no, your permit's good for 2 years unless you give it up. Our liveaboard ordinance does have a provision in there, again, that if you're gone for an extended absence, you can request to have it kept active. If a fisherman were to go for a really long time, I could see that being an issue that could be addressed through our existing ordinance, but no, you wouldn't lose it. It's not leave and lose it. As long as your permit's active, you're good.
So basically, this liveaboard permit will be a 2-year permit, somewhat similar to the current recreational one that we have now, but it's just going to be for commercial fishing boats. Is that correct?
Well, currently commercial. If you're living aboard a commercial fishing boat, you're supposed to have a liveaboard permit.
Okay.
Whether you're wherever you are.
I see.
If you're home ported.
Yes. Yeah. There's an allow, like the code reads, if you live aboard for more than 60 days in any 12-month period, and I wasn't around when this was created. I started right after, and my understanding, that provision was there for the commercial boats that come seasonally, the albacore, salmon, whatever, and these guys are living aboard. 60 days seemed like, a reasonable amount for a typical season. They're not here much longer than that, and they go away, and that makes them not a live aboard.
I see. Okay. Yeah, Neil?
Is there, do you guys have a good reason for limiting the number to three? Or was there ever thought of, having more, maybe shortening the term? Because, you have three on a pier and those three guys are all gone for 2 years. Now there's nobody living at the pier, but there's definitely boats there that are sneaking aboard. And like you're talking about, is there any reason why you wouldn't want to have either shorter terms or more permits?
I don't think we want to create a whole different permitting scheme. We've got the liveaboard ordinance that says 2 years, and you've got to do A, B, C, and D, and it fits in. It fits in with what we're doing. It's just per the live boat ordinance, you're not allowed at the pier. This just changes that to, yeah, you are allowed at the pier. As far as why a number, I don't think we want to see the piers turned into total live aboard boats. I don't think they will. You know, there's only a few guys that do it. So I don't see it. I don't see a rush, a land rush for guys trying to live aboard the pier, but I think it could be detrimental if the whole pier is completely full of live aboards, but I don't see that ever occurring.
This just helps regulate the ones that are there and to have some enforcement issues and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, but three wasn't magic by any means. It was
right.
Just
okay.
A Lynn? Number. Correct. Under the current ordinance, correct.
Able to stay on the boat on the pier.
Correct.
So those are two separate issues.
Yeah, that's currently in the live aboard ordinance, they can do that.
Right. So it's just changing the municipal code to allow them to stay on the pier.
To allow live aboard use of the pier, our recommendation for commercial fishing boats that could qualify per our regular. Yeah, then they become, yeah, the 60 days was, like I said, for transient boats coming through. If you're more than 60 days, you're not transient anymore.
My question is there not a state, I don't know if it's regulation or just by custom, that says 10% of the boats can be liveaboard boats because it's...
That is true.
Yes. State Lands Commission is our landlord, and their state, whether it's in statute or not, I don't know, but it's their policy that in any public harbor that no more than 10% of the boat population be liveaboards. And that's, and again, there's our magical 500 number of boats.
Right.
When we created the liveaboard ordinance, that number became 50 because our count was 500 boats, therefore 50 permits issued at any given time.
So with the three...
I don't
six.
Think...
Or the six that you are allotting with that would fall under
the... Yeah, it would fall under the same. And I don't... No, and we're in... We've got pretty good compliance right now. We're in the mid-30s. So I've... And only on a couple occasions have I ever seen it even get close to that 50 number, even with the sneaker board. So we're under it. Yeah.
We would not exceed our allowable number. And I'm all in favor of this board.
Okay.
Ron?
In spite of Lynn's excellent comments and question, I'm still confused. Is it the case that you are proposing, Mr. Harbor Director, that these liveaboards, these commercial vessel liveaboards, would conform if it was one day or 100 days, that they would conform to the current harbor liveaboard ordinance?
They would have to,
yes.
In order to live aboard the boat, yes, they would have to conform to the live aboard ordinance. We would lift the limit, no live aboards on the T pier to allow, you know, up to three commercial fishing vessels.
Okay, and my next question has to do with the paren that you have in your recommendation, say on a first come, first served basis. I do understand those words. Paragraph 4 of Exhibit A of the rules and regs states, quote, first come, first served on a daily basis. So is what you're proposing in any way conflicting with that? And it's just sort of a point of order, if you will.
No, I don't think so. I think first come, first serve, meaning if Manny, Moe, and Jack get liveaboard permits for their commercial fishing boats, then that three has been met for that pier. And when Fred comes along, he can't get a permit.
Well, I understand that part, but I read paragraph 4 of Exhibit A, of the existing rules and regs, and it just, and I wasn't sure whether it was going to apply to this or not.
I don't think so. Of the regular rules and regulations?
And we have this wonderful...
Yeah, that'll teach me to give you that.
And we have this wonderful document that...
So where are you on the rules and regulations?
Exhibit A, paragraph 4.
Of the staff report?
No.
Of what?
Of the City of Morro Bay Harbor Department rules and regulations...
Gotcha. Exhibit A. Okay.
T piers, docks, and offshore
moorings. Paragraph 4. T piers, floating dock, or anchorage area shall be available to registered transient vessels on a first come, first served daily basis at fees established in the master fee schedule, except that no vessel may use the anchorage area or floating dock for more than 30 days in any 6 month period.
So, does that, I just want to make sure that that has no relevance to the policy that you're proposing.
No, I do not believe it does. No.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Eric?
Alan?
One thing that kind of pops up in my mind is that, okay, now these guys have these liveaboard permits, and they've got, I'm North Pier, I'm South Pier, but the fishermen have never operated that way. You know, you just come in and tie up wherever, you know, there's a space. And then there's also the other factor of somebody comes in and this guy's saying, well, I'm a liveaboard and this is my spot. You know, I've seen people talk about my spot on the tee pier, and that's never a pleasant conversation either.
No, some folks have gotten sort of territorial on
This is
spot.
Just something that you, as the policeman, have to deal with. I mean,
yeah,
it's kind of like it's a public pier, you know, first come, first serve. I had this discussion with my neighbor today about a public street, you know. I mean, they're allowed to park wherever they want, and if they leave, someone might take their spot.
Yeah, and it's a good point.
Right. It is.
No, if we enact this and if you get a liveaboard permit because you're a commercial fisherman on the pier, no, it doesn't entitle you to a certain spot.
Right.
Still, the pier, per really that rule that Ron just pointed out, it's still first come, first serve space basis. You're just allowed a liveaboard.
But you are limited to which pier you can
so
liveaboard at?
So back to your second point, it's an interesting point. I think historically, maybe a couple exceptions, but for the most part, boats gravitate to one pier or the other, and that kind of tends to be their pier. I know the liveaboard you're referring to, he's pretty exclusively North T Pier. I don't think he's ever been at the South, unless with that old 90-day rate where he had to move for a day. And then the Asian fleet, the live guys and the black cotters, they all are at the South T Pier, and everyone kind of ends up staying. So it may... And I can see a potential coming where the possibility, okay, you've got your three on each pier, and Manny on the North T Pier where he's permitted, he goes fishing for a couple months, and he comes back, and there's this giant squid bite going on, and the pier's totally crowded, and the only space is over at the South T Pier. How do we deal with that? Well, let's...
Let it go. Yeah. Put this discretion.
You still got six total that have been issued for the two piers. Yeah, if one guy's temporarily down there, then... That's fine. It doesn't mean all of a sudden we can open up another one. So, yeah, I think,
yeah. Okay.
Don't see it as a big problem.
Okay, I agree. I think we concur too, Eric. I think these next two folks here are fairly straightforward, so let's see if we can tackle both of these and call it a night. Eliminating the $1 day non-mooring holder skip tie-up fees at the city head float areas.
So many years ago, there was a fair number of boats, probably half a dozen little skiffs that were plying the bay regularly, mostly recreational fishermen, but a couple little small-scale commercial guys that wanted to keep their boat somewhere in the bay, and we didn't have a slip for them because they're too small and they didn't know where to go. So we had some unused space at the head floats, basically between the head float and the rocks, to allow them to tie up, and it was a buck a day. And it worked okay when these guys were active. Most of those guys are gone. There's a couple left that have pretty much just left their boats, and they're full of rainwater and green stuff, and to track them at a buck a day for Polly and Lori to figure out who they are and where they are and how many days they were there, it costs more in staff time to track them. We're getting out of it. But we do still see some value in providing that boating opportunity. If somebody comes along, and the ones we have now have kind of entrenched in on a permanent basis as just a storage spot for their boat rather than actively using it, and they're just in the way, and it's not serving its original purpose. But I do see a valid use for boats that need a temporary stay and recraft this thing in a more temporary basis to where you're limited on how much time you can stay there, and instead of a buck a day, which is, you know, basically giving it away because we're not recouping any of that, it goes up to $3 a day. And again, at our discretion, if space is available. So that's what we're recommending to do and getting rid of the old dollar a day provision.
So you're recommending to go up to $3?
Okay.
For the ones that really currently use them for
the
purpose.
$3 a day, 30 days in any six-month period, mirrors the anchorage and the floating seal dock. So it mirrors that one, which was put in place as a transient type of use that was established long ago, and so mirroring that same 30-day and six-month period, $3 a day. And if you're coming down, you just want to put your boat in the water for a month because you want to go use it for the summer, fine. We've got a couple other spots that we've rented on a more permanent basis. I think one of our advisory board members, who shall remain nameless, is partaking or has partaken of that in the past. No, I'm not talking about you, Neil. We've got one of our oyster operators who's renting a couple spaces basically at our head float rate, which is a whole different, it's more of a permanent slip assignment. But our other oyster operator at the other end is on that oddball dollar a day thing, and he's really not a small skiff, and I don't know how he ended up on that, so he would be more of the head float rate that Neil's on now. And
is that the point of the last sentence of your recommendation? You're saying that that's an exception that wouldn't continue?
Yeah, that is the one kind of oddball exception that we seem to have.
That will continue or not continue?
No, I think that operation down to the other end, down by the launch ramp, really should be at the head float rate. It's more of a slip assignment because that's kind of a permanent space for them, kind of like what Neil has.
I see. Okay. Okay, questions here. Gene, do you have anything?
No.
Alan?
Yeah, do you think maybe that the $3 a day might just take care of the whole thing without having to go to the 30 days? I mean, for $3 a day, the people that are just going to storm there, they might just pack up and go at that.
Yeah, it could. Interesting point, yeah. Paying $90 a month for nothing to collect rainwater.
Yeah, Lynn?
Yeah, so that's sort of what I was going to add. You're still going to have the same administrative process of having to track them or to track them down and collect from them. So it's just that upping it to $3, number one, will eliminate some of the problems, and number two, will recoup some of the expense in tracking. Are my assumptions right?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, another way to look at it, a potential looking at it, is 30-day minimum. You want to stay for 15 days, or you're going to pay for a month, and we don't have to go count how many days you're there. You're just paying for 30 days, and there's your limit.
Let me have $90.
Yeah. Then we don't have to track it. So I know, you know, Paul and Laurie are like,
you don't have to track it on a daily basis.
Don't have to go check, see if he's there, count. Oh, yeah, he's there, because that's how we still are kind of in the Stone Age when it comes to our dockage. Someday we'll modernize that, but we count day by day.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Ron.
I support the recommendation as presented by the harbor director. I would encourage the inclusion of the minimum stay of the year. What was the last thing that you said so succinctly, Eric?
Rather than
starting to get tongue-tied, Ron.
Rather than $3 a day, you know, for up to 30 days, and we count how many days you're there and bill you at the end. It's just 30-day minimum.
Yes,
the 30-day minimum.
The 30-day minimum. And I have a point, I guess, which I would leave entirely to you. I noticed in Section 9 of the current code, as well as in your recommendation, there's reference to skiffs and dinghies. In your case, you said small skiffs and dinghies. It seems to me what's missing from the code, and what I would encourage the Harbor Department to think about in terms of your recommendation policy is what is the size? What is the maximum size of such a vessel? I can share with you that a review of the 20 or 25 or whatever other harbor rules and regulations that I've looked over in the last year for various and sundry reasons, there's often a maximum size. And beyond that, it's a whole different moorage issue.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. I think the moving forward with this, it's the $3 a day, or 90 a month, whichever you want to call it, head float rate, 30-day limit for skiffs and dinghies, and we add definition for skiff and dinghies in our definitions and backtrack to those definitions. And I don't recall if we discussed
We did discuss that they were getting longer and longer and they weren't fitting in the spaces, right.
So we get a definition for skiffs and dinghies, we say this is for skiffs and dinghies, and then we're set.
Yeah, and you folks know what the size, what the practical size is, because you deal with it all day long every day. So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Any other discussion on this particular one, number 8? No? Okay. Eric, last one would be the number 12, no overhead casting in certain areas. I think that's a no-brainer. Let's do it.
So, again, the issue is
you're a chairman.
I know.
You just want to go home. Overhead casting interfering with public passersby. We do encourage access to the beach and to the water, and we've built many facilities to accommodate that, not the least of which is our little street end docks that have those overlook piers where people love to fish from. That's now been extended a lot of times now to Tidelands Dock, which can cause conflicts, and now there's folks that are fishing off the boardwalk because it's a nice, easy spot to get to along the revetment, leading out to Target Rock into the Rock, and we've run into some folks, some conflicts now, and most piers I think that you go to around the state and a lot of places, no overhead casting is allowed. You got to figure out how to flick it underhand so you're not hooking somebody behind you and creating problems. So we looked at this back in November and we said, yep, let's look at it. So I would recommend that prohibition of overhead casting in certain public areas. I wouldn't include the beaches because those are obviously public areas, or the jetties, although not a lot of people fish from the jetties, just because if you fish in the North Jetty, you may not live long being up there.
You're proposing mostly the piers and the boardwalk area.
Yeah, piers, boardwalk, those sort of docks, if public docks people fish off of.
Ron?
I might suggest that the easier way to state this is an excellent idea, the easier way to state it is where you can overhead cast, because I think it's going to be a pretty short list.
Okay. I'll write it both ways, see which is shorter and simpler to manage.
It seems to me you'd have to name all those street end locations, and the list would be long. Seems to me the other list is really pretty short.
Yeah. Well, one of the troubles is going to be, and I'm not a huge advocate for more signs.
Right.
But if you've got a prohibition on something, you need to sign it. So your that method would be overhead casting okay.
Seems backwards.
I acknowledge your point. Sorry. Actually, about the prohibition sign.
And then you get the other sign out.
So basically, with this new ordinance, you will have to have signage, correct? In order to enforce it, because the public then needs to be aware of it.
Yep.
Okay. But I definitely think that we need to do it. We need to address what are the areas that you do not want to have any overhead casting because of conflicts. And I definitely could see probably the whole boardwalk, really should be off limits with all that activity. And
There's other places where the boardwalk turns out to the Rock along the revetment there.
Right, yeah.
Plenty of other places.
Yeah. Okay. Dana?
Yeah. Just in regards to docks, I thought there was no fishing on the docks, because that's been a problem. Coming into the Tidelands Dock,
and there's people with their chairs and everything, their tackle boxes sitting there fishing, they're not going to move for you. They just look at you.
There's currently on our street end docks, like below the galley, you know, those small recreational docks, those are signed, and those do have a prohibition from fishing. Tidelands?
Should.
I'm not sure. I'm going to flim through here real quick and see if I can find that. It's a good point.
Yeah, it is a very good point.
I don't think Tidelands has that prohibition.
Well, this would be one I think that we should probably...
Yeah, shore fishing and angling shall not be permitted from the viewing platforms or the floating dock at the ends of Harbor Street, Morbid Boulevard, Marina Street, and Anchor Street. So those are the four street end docks and overhead viewing platforms. So where you can go is the one at Anchor Park, Anchor Memorial Park, that little overlook, and I believe the one between Marina Square and Aquarium, that one's okay. It's the ones that have the docks, the four that have the little docks down below that you can't. Tidelands, Tidelands is mixed for me because there's a fair amount of folks that come out at night. You know, those night fishermen, they're a different breed sometimes, and they're out there a lot at night fishing, and no one's using the dock. So yeah, it's a good point though.
That sounds good. I'm just saying during the daytime, I've seen people camped out there with their chairs, coolers, everything. And I've got kids that I'm coaching sailing, and we're coming over to the dock.
Yeah.
And we can't. It's like I have to have them come around where the dinghies tie up, but I have my coach boat, maybe there's another coach boat, and a couple sailboats, and these guys are looking at us like we're not moving.
Yeah, I've personally, when I used to have my little boat, I had a run-in with a guy, same thing. It's like, yeah. I mean, if there's consensus for that, I'm happy to carry that forward. Because it is a problem. I mean, you've got the whole revetment between there and Associated Pacific that you could fish from.
Well, I'm not a big fan of rules and regulations, but it seems like, as you just stated, that the problem is during the daytime, not at night. So, you know, it's kind of like no overhead fishing, no fishing on this dock between the hours of, you know.
Maybe make it the opposite hours of the,
yeah.
Because the day, you know, that dock is supposed to be between, I forget what the hours are, but.
Correct.
Day use only. We could do fishing okay if on the flip side of that.
Yeah.
Existing signage. Okay.
That's.
Are they fishing off that dock because California Fishing Code doesn't require a fishing license off any city-owned dock?
No, that doesn't apply there. You do need a license. The Fishing Game Code reads that no license is required on any public pier designed for and available for recreational fishing. And our two-tier T-piers, while they're primarily commercial fishing, they're also recreational, and they are actually listed on Fish and Game's list, and then on jetties, forming the outermost boundary of a harbor, count as piers. They also don't need a license, but no, everything else, you need a license.
I was just wondering, because you were talking about the revetment, I wanted to make sure those people, if they're there, they have to have a license,
they
could be displaced to the revetment.
T-piers, no license, jetties, no license, Cayucas Pier, Pismo Pier, no license, just those kind of piers.
Okay, we have any other questions, Gene?
Oh, I was just saying on the Tidelands Dock, some kind of compromise is needed. So,
split the difference, day, night.
Hey, do you think about like a school zone possibly also with language, you know, when people in boats are present?
People in boats are always present.
You know, like when lights are flashing?
Well, okay, any other questions on this ordinance? Ron? Do you have anything else to discuss on this ordinance?
I don't, thank
you. Okay. So, okay, I think you have our direction on these operational ordinances, see fit. If there's no other questions here, we'd like to go back to our agenda and see what we have next. And I do apologize, I wasn't trying to be, I think I was probably being flippant more than anything else, so... I do need to have consensus. We already discussed the new business and declaration of future agenda items.
Mr. Chairman, you have item C3.
Oh, I apologize. Update from the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee on committee's recent activities. Since Jeff was the chair on that, and we discussed this, me and Ron, earlier.
We have not met, so there is no activities. Ron, how would you like to proceed? Would you like to have someone else be on that committee, or do you want to discuss this at a later date?
No, I think it's a good idea to have three people. I mean, that way there's an opportunity, you know, for an odd count, if you will. And I would respectfully suggest that, given that this is a financial-related committee, that we solicit a volunteer from the board who feels that they have the background and the willingness to participate.
So with that, is there anyone here on the board who would like to raise their hand to be on the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee? I second the motion. Neil? You are on the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee. You'll get our agendas from Ron and myself. Thank you.
If I can add to that, we are starting to warm up to the budget for this upcoming fiscal year. We've done our mid-year review. I would suggest that the Ad Hoc Committee and myself at some point in probably either late this month or March get together if we want to try and form a more cohesive way of moving forward with this. I know our new city managers were, the city council on Tuesday is considering a financial oversight committee to start looking at the city's budgeting process and have some kind of oversight. And there's been talk of the applicable advisory boards and bodies potentially having a membership role in this new financial committee as well. So we've kind of already got a head start on that with this ad hoc committee, so I'd propose that either late this month or, like say, early March, when I start warming up to the budget. I know there's a published budget schedule in next week's city council meeting and when we're proposing to have the workshops and all that kind of stuff, and if we can get a little more formal this year with the ad hoc committee and have you guys sit down with me and we go through, including the capital list, and even include that as part of my staff report for my budget stuff when I present it up through to the city council, you know, the budget ad hoc, Harbor Advisory Board ad hoc, financial committees reviewed, and blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Neil's your next-door neighbor. Ron has some time, and I have some time. I will contact you, and we'll make a meeting at the end of this month or beginning of March.
And we'll look at that council agenda item for next week and see what that budget schedule is. At some point, we really don't start until financial services, Susan Slayton, gives us all of the last year's financial actuals so we know how we performed, and then front loads the personnel and all the hard costs that she already knows are already going to be there, and gives us those spreadsheets to start plugging in a number. So once we get those, then I've got a working document to start plugging numbers in and estimating revenues and doing all that, and that's where the ad hoc committee would come in at that point. So we'd have to look at that schedule and see where that falls in.
Okay.
Okay.
Then I'll call you. Okay, Dana? Yes. Now, you also mentioned that you might be able to get the state parks for the Marina, Brooke, is that her name, to maybe discuss their plans there?
Yeah, so the state park marina, as you hinted at there, and I think at the December meeting, I asked that, stated that I'd possibly be bringing some activity on the state park marina to the February meeting. That was where we're at with that, is Parks did a financial feasibility study on three different alternatives to move forward with the dredging and maintenance and overall rebuild of that marina, and they want to take that study and daylight it in a public forum and get public input, advisory board input, on which potential ways the public and city want to move forward. We'd hope to be ready for that in February. That report got done back in August or September, but with Parks, with Nick Franco leaving Parks and bailing off to the county on us. Lost a lot of our institutional knowledge, so Parks wasn't ready to go in February. So I'm meeting with Parks by phone, I think, next week to go look at next steps. So potentially we can bring that in March. I'm hoping for it. It just kind of depends on Parks and whether they're ready for it.
You know, this would be a good tie-in, too, for your meetings in Washington if they're willing to go forward here, because, you know, the big albatross is to the dredging underneath the docks, of course. And if you know, there's money to be made to be able to, or at least mitigate, to be able to actually offshore do that in conjunction with the 2016-2017 dredging all the way to the channel, that would be a good timeline. I mean, I would think.
Yeah, it'd be coming up pretty quick. It depends on whether we get funded. But, you know, when we did our mooring area dredging in 2000, I can't remember, 5, 6, I think it's about 2004, 2005. As soon as Corps of Engineers had a contractor on contract on the hook for doing that, we piggybacked on.
Correct.
And that way we didn't have to pay for their mobilization and demob and just for moving yardage. So, yeah, that would be an opportune time to try and cut some of that cost if we can dispose of it in that manner.
Correct.
Yep. Good point.
Okay. Dana.
Yeah, one other thing. This, I don't know if it needs to be an agenda item, but maybe it can be in the staff report, and that would be an update on the Coast Guard facilities as far as what you know. I spoke recently with Andrew Johnson, I believe is his name, the officer.
Adam Johnson.
Adam.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
I'm He's sorry. A returnee. He was here 8 years ago.
Oh, okay. Anyways, and he told me a bit about what's going on, but I know there's rumors, and it would just be nice to clear that up and give us the latest, greatest on what's going on.
Put that in the status report.
Yeah, if you could.
Okay.
Any other items for future agenda items? Ron?
Just a question. Eric, on the synopsis of minutes, the most recent one, by that I mean December, the habitual list of declared future agenda items does not appear. Can we get that declared list going forward in the minute synopsis?
Yeah, I didn't see it in this last one.
There are four declared agenda items. Future agenda items declared by the board that are still open.
Yeah, we can get that back on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Now, I would think that as we move forward here, we're going to tackle either A or B next meeting, too. Would that be the correct statement,
yep.
Eric?
Yeah, that would be my intent.
Okay. So you picked which one that we would go, and hopefully we'd do it the same way we're doing right now. All right.
Okay.
Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Dana? Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
I hear a first and a second. All in favor? All opposed?
I like the dictator approach.